My name is Mark Schwing, and I'm here for a couple of weeks from Valparaiso, Indiana. It's about an hour outside of Chicago, and there I teach at Valparaiso University in the Honors College, Christ College, which I also serve as dean. And during 2 weeks here at Holden Village, I guess this must be about when we started coming to Holden in 1979, and have almost been here every year in between 1979 and now, so I think it's been about 16 years, missed one or two. And these 2 weeks I'm going to be talking about love and friendship. This week, erotic love or romantic love, and next week, friendship. As I explained on Monday, yesterday, I arrived at the choice to speak about these matters in thinking about the theme, No Longer Strangers, and wondering whether at least one way to think of what the opposite of being a stranger might look like would be to be a lover or a friend. And one might at least explore the possibility that at least one way to address the difficulty of alienation or estrangement would be to think about love, the passion, and friendship, the virtue, and see what those look like. I should say that in thinking through that matter, it became apparent to me quickly that one shouldn't draw too sharp a contrast between lovers and friends on the one hand and strangers on the other. After all, there is the film with the title Lovers and Other Strangers. And in looking through one of my favorite books, which some of you may have read, Norman Maclean's A River Runs Through It. If you haven't read the book, you might have seen the film. I discover at the very end of that book, a certain line resonated in my mind as I was thinking about strangers and lovers and friends and families. And that's the line that comes as the father and the son who has survived try to make sense of the brother's life and how it happened to come to such a tragic end. And the father speaking to the son says, after you have finished your true story sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. So that there's a sense here that love's knowledge, though love's knowledge may be deep and profound, nonetheless has its own limitations, and sometimes we find that those who are in some sense closest to us are those who elude us and in some sense are strange and strangers to us. Indeed, it's been said by some that many of us are strangers even to ourselves. And if one believes in the principle of self-love, one would then find another instance of how we should be wary of drawing too sharp a distinction between being strangers and being lovers and friends. Still, having said that, let me review for some of you and inform anew others who are here for the first time something of the program and where this session fits in. This week is erotic love or romantic love, and we're in the second of three sessions. Next week is friendship. On Monday, yesterday, we took up a strange text, strange because distant from us in space and time, part of one of Plato's dialogues called the Symposium, and in particular a speech by Aristophanes, who was a comic poet and who is figured as a character in that dialogue, who tells this weird story about the birth of Eros. And we read that story aloud strange myth about how there were once three different kinds of beings, males, females, and hermaphrodites, or androgynous creatures. They were perfectly round, and they became rebellious, and the gods chose to punish them by cleaving them right down the center. So where there was one perfect circle, there were now two beings. And if you were split and were a male, you were split into two males. If you were round and a female, child of the earth, you were split, and there were two female parts. And then if you were an androgynous person, there was a male and a female part. And no sooner did this split take place than people longed to be together and rushed back into each other's arms to embrace, because they had this deep and profound and insatiable longing to be whole again, because they were just parts. And Zeus took pity on them, since they were dying in one another's arms. They couldn't work, couldn't eat, they couldn't sleep, they just clung to one another, and performed another act of surgery, which made it possible for them to have sex with one another. That seemed to work, because for the males and males and females and females, sexual embrace acted as a kind of release for that longing so that they could get about their lives. And for the males and females, of course, clinging to one another, it also was a mode of procreation. And we talked a long time about how that myth really, and also we talked a little bit about Genesis, the great story in Genesis 2 and 3, and noted that what they had in common was the notion that erotic love was bound up not fundamentally with sexuality and with sexual longing, but of a more profound spiritual longing for wholeness or completion found in another, and that human beings, though they may have once been, if you're in Genesis, you think about Eden, and if you're in the Greek story, think about the original state, though they may once have been whole and living in harmony with one another in the world, that something happened that made them less than whole and needy and dependent and vulnerable, and so that they needed an other to find fullness and completion. And Eros then became the name for that desire and for that pursuit of wholeness. One of the people who was here last time rushed up to me with a Newsweek magazine, this most recent Newsweek, as though to vindicate the suggestion that some of these notions are very much alive with us. And it features under Newsmakers this photo of one of Hollywood's more glamorous couples, Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow. Brad Pitt, by the way, played the brother in A River Runs Through It, who actually is killed. But in any event, they were the Hollywood glamour couple and became engaged last November and so forth and so on. And they broke up. This is terrible. But now I want to read you what she said here. Those of you who went through the whole symposium story with me will appreciate this. Even before Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow got engaged last Thanksgiving, she told Newsweek, quote, "I found the person I'm complete with." And he declared, "She's totally amazing. She makes me feel whole." So you see, there they were. It's just that they obviously found the wrong other half and discovered this. Newsweek is obscure about just exactly what it was that they discovered, to see that they'd run into the arms of the wrong other half. But at least initially there was this feeling of wholeness and completeness, and that's the kind of vocabulary they use. Okay, so the notion is that by taking up that text, and now by taking up another text today from the medieval period, we're going to hear from folks in very different contexts from our own. Yesterday it was from the Greeks and from a culture, an elite male culture that was very homoerotic. This time we switch to the Middle Ages and to the 12th century and to the world of the troubadours and the great courts of France that were often presided over by great women like Eleanor of Aquitaine, and that featured the traveling poets, the troubadours, and that featured the development of a chivalric code that went along with the feudal society a world that is very much heterosexual, that is very much thinking of love in exclusively heterosexual terms, and a world that features for us, if we can trust most of our social and literary and intellectual historians, the birth of what was called then courtly love, or fin amour, French, fine love, and has come down to us as romantic love. This is the same period in which a new genre of literature arose, the romance. And Chrétien de Troyes, one of the famous writers of the period, wrote a romance called Lancelot, and another one called Yvain. And the popularity of the Lancelot stories has been quite enduring in the West. Most recently, some of you may have seen the film First Knight, on Arthur and the Round Table and Guinevere and Lancelot and the whole group. That kind of story, that kind of myth, that kind of romance dates from this period. So now I'm going to distribute a handout that comes from a book written in the 12th century by a clerk who is named Andreas Papalanis, clerk or cleric.
I'm writing this on the board because I think after you read this, a number of you are going to want to run out and buy this book. It's called The Art of Courtly Love. And unlike the book we read last time, which was part of a Platonic dialogue and featured a myth, this book may be the first book we have in the West of one of those how-to-do-it books that we find in every bookstore several shelves worth, particularly in relationships. You know, how to woo men, how to woo women, how to get married, how to get out of marriage, how to make love, how to, you know, whatever. So there are all kinds of guidebooks that give advice and counsel and provide all kinds of wisdom. And this book sought to do that for a particular stratum of courtly society. And we're going to look at it and see, as we did the last time, just how much of ourselves we can see in it, in this distant mirror, how much of our own practices and sentiments and values bound up with romantic love can we see in that distant mirror, how different are these people from ourselves, and can we get some critical perspective on how we think of romance and romantic love by listening to these words that are distant and far away. But just as I had people perform a little exercise last time before distributing the text in coming up with words that they associated with erotic, and by the way, for those of you who weren't here, most of the words that went up on the board at that point had to do with sex. In fact, one of the words was sex. We had nudity, we had adult movies, we had sensuality, we had, I think, fun. Anyway, they clustered around sexuality, and the interesting thing about the text that we looked at then was that sexuality was not a very prominent feature of the description of erotic love in the Greek texts, nor in the Hebrew. So today I want to ask you to do something different. I want you to take about 30 seconds and think about a play or a book or a film that comes to your mind when you think of romantic love. What play or book or film really captures for you romantic love? I'll give you 30 seconds to think about that, and I'll ask you to call out the titles. Can you spell Bergerac?
No.
Well, we'll just give it a...
Yeah, that's right. It was the modern day Roxanne.
Right. Good.
West Side Story?
And does anybody know what West Side Story is the kind of modern version of? Okay. Any else?
Funny Things.
Funny Things?
Funny Face.
Funny Face.
Sarah and Bobby.
Okay.
An Affair to Remember.
An Affair to Remember?
Out of Africa.
Bridges of Madison County?
Oh, okay, good. My very popular book a couple of years ago, still popular. Big movie with Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood.
Razor's Edge.
Razor's Edge?
Yeah.
Out of Africa.
Oh, Out of Africa. Another Meryl Streep, only this time he started with Robert Redford rather than Clint Eastwood.
Casablanca.
Casablanca, one of the great ones.
Dr. Zhivago.
Dr. Zhivago. How's that? Okay, I think we've got enough up here. I think we'll try the idea of one for two. You can take one, and then from now on, just take one hand out for every two people. Anybody not near one?
Okay.
There's one here. Another leftover? Okay. Now, as I read this, I'm going to read these couple of pages, and we're going to all profit. You're going to come away from this class, unlike last class, which, you know, you left just reading this text and thinking about love. Now you're going to get some advice. You're getting some tips. So, you know, say, when you leave this class the week, say, well, it was kind of, some of it we didn't quite get, but we got some good ideas. We got some tips, you see, from somebody in the 12th century at the very beginning of romantic love, see? I've included, because I know most of you already are in love or have been, I've included some advice on the second page about how once you've got love, you can make it increase. But we'll come to that in a minute. Don't peek at that yet. First, book one. And this gives you an idea of what's in this treatise here. We must first consider what love is, whence it gets its name, what the effect of love is, between what persons love may exist, how it may be acquired, retained, increased, decreased, and ended. What are the signs that one's love is returned, and what one of the lovers ought to do if the other is unfaithful. So that's the whole outline of the book. We're not going to read that whole outline. We're going to talk about the definition. I'm going to talk a little bit about how love can be increased. Now, as I'm reading this, I ask you to put these on the board for a reason, because what I want you to kind of think about in the back of your minds is how many of the motifs and themes and ideas and notions that surface in this 12th century text do you think are dramatized or present
in these contemporary, for the most part, works of literature or film. So here we go. What love is? Love is a certain inborn suffering, derived from the sight of and excessive meditation upon the beauty of the opposite sex, which causes each one to wish above all things the embraces of the other, and by common desire to carry out all of love's precepts in the other's embrace. Okay, now he's going to take up each term of that definition. What does he mean, love is suffering? That love is suffering is easy to see. For before the love becomes equally balanced on both sides, there is no torment greater, since the lover is always in fear that his love may not gain its desire and that he's wasting his efforts. He fears, too, that rumors of it may get abroad, and he fears everything that might harm it in any way, for before things are perfected, a slight disturbance always spoils them, often spoils them. If he's a poor man, he also fears that the woman may scorn his poverty. If he's ugly, he fears that she may despise his lack of beauty or may give her love to a more handsome man. If he's rich, he fears that his parsimony in the past may stand in his way. And tell the truth, no one can number the fears of a single one. This kind of love, then, is a suffering, which is felt by only one of the persons and may be called single love. But even after both are in love, the fears that arise are just as great, for now each of the lovers fears that what he has acquired with so much effort may be lost through the effort of someone else, which is certainly much worse for a man than if, having no hope, he sees that his efforts are accomplishing nothing. For it is worse to lose the things you are seeking than to be deprived of a gain you merely hope for. The lover fears, too, that he may offend his loved one in some way. Indeed, he fears so many things that it would be difficult to tell. So, boy, it's suffering, according to this letter. Now, what was he mean by it's inborn? That this suffering is inborn, I shall show you clearly, because if you will look at the truth and distinguish carefully, you will see that it does not arise out of any action. It's not something that's happened to you, someone's hit you over the head or something, and that's what causes your suffering. It comes from inside. Only from the reflection of the mind upon what it sees does this suffering come. For when a man sees some woman fit for love and shaped according to his taste, and I think here we can reverse the genders, the woman sees a man shaped according to her taste, he or she begins at once to lust after him or her in his heart. So lust comes first. Then, the more he thinks about her, the more he burns with love until he comes to a fuller meditation. Presently, he begins to think about the fashioning of the woman and to differentiate her limbs, to think about what she does, and to pry into the secrets of her body, and he desires to put each part of it to the fullest use. Then, after he has come to this complete meditation, love cannot hold the reins any longer, but he proceeds at once to action. Straight away, he strives to get a helper and to find an intermediary. He begins to plan how he might find favor with her. He begins to seek a place and a time opportune for talking. He looks upon a brief hour as a very long year because he cannot do anything fast enough to suit his eager mind. It is well known that many things happen to him in this manner. His inborn suffering comes, therefore, from seeing and meditating. Not every kind of meditation can be the cause of love. An excessive one is required. For a restrained thought does not, as a rule, return to the mind, and so love cannot arise from it. Okay, so this is basically what love is. We can return to that, see if we think, recognize definitions of romance today there. But now I don't want the class to end without giving you some counsel here, so I think how love once consummated may be increased. And we, again, just think about whether you hear any of this advice today, not in the same words, but you hear this kind of folk wisdom even today in different forms. Here it is. We shall attempt to show you in a few words how love may be increased after it has been consummated. Now, in the first place, it's said to increase if the lovers see each other only rarely and with difficulty. For the greater the difficulty of exchanging solaces, the more do the desire for them and the feeling of love increase. Love increases, too, if one of the lovers shows that he's angry at the other. For the lover falls at once into a great fear that this feeling which has arisen in his beloved may last forever. Love increases, likewise, if one of the lovers feels real jealousy, which is called, in fact, the nurse of love. Even if he does not suffer from real jealousy, but from a shameful suspicion, still, by virtue of this, his love always increases and grows more powerful. What constitutes real jealousy and what shameful suspicion, you can easily see in the discussion between the man of the higher nobility and the noblewoman. That's another section of the book. Love increases too, if it happens to last after it has been made public. Ordinarily, it does not last. Once people find it out, it's over. But sometimes it lasts after it's been made public. And when it does, it increases. Again, if one of the lovers dreams about the other, that gives rise to love. Or if love already exists, it increases it. So too, if you know that someone is trying to win your beloved away from you, that will no doubt increase your love, and you will begin to feel more affection for her. I will go further and say that even though you know perfectly well that some other man is enjoying the embraces of your beloved, this will make you begin to value her solaces all the more, unless your greatness of soul and nobility of mind keep you from such wickedness. When you have gone to some other place or are about to go away, that increases your love. And so do the scoldings and beatings that lovers suffer from their parents. For not only does a scolding lecture cause love to increase after it's perfected, but it even gives a perfect reason for beginning a love affair that has not yet started. In other words, if your parents say, you can't be that person, I will not permit him in the house, love starts. Right there. So there it is. Frequent dwelling with delight on the thought of the beloved is a value in increasing love. Notice, dwelling or imagining the beloved frequently increases love. But being with the beloved actually doesn't increase it. It kind of decreases it. So the sort of seedbed for this kind of romantic passion is really in the imagination, is excessive meditation. So when they're gone, you see, and you think about them a lot, this increases love. When they're there, this decreases love. I mean, this, you can see that a little bit on the what ways might love be decreased. Love is greatly intensified by a carriage and a way of walking that pleases the beloved, by a readiness to say pretty things, by a pleasant manner of speaking, and by hearing men sing the praises of the loved one. There are doubtless still other things by which love is increased, which you can find out for yourself if you will study the matter attentively and if you have paid careful attention to those things that we have set down. For all the other things that are effective in such an affair seem to be dependent upon those which we have mentioned and to grow out of them. Okay, so there's a little advice for you, and there's a description and a definition of romantic love, coming right out of the period that produces the first great romances, like Lancelot. Okay, now, I ask you to think a little bit about these films. What if, or books, novels, what if anything do you see in those that would tend to, let's first of all suggest, things that are like what you've read, things that pick up some of these motifs?
Well, in West Side Story, Maria and Tony, thank you. They were, you know, just because of the boundaries in their different walks of life, they were forbidden to be together. And that made their love grow stronger. And the more they were told that that was no, the more they feverishly tried to be together.
Okay, good.
And same with Romeo and
same
Juliet.
Same with Romeo and Juliet. Excellent. In other words, right here at our beginning of definition, we had the notion that it's a suffering. It's born of this meditation, and later we learned that it's only if you see the lover infrequently and with difficulty that kind of makes love increase. So that we get this theme arising that love of this sort thrives on obstacles. And boy, in West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet, we just have all kinds of obstacles, right? Two families that hate one another, very few opportunities to meet. And sure enough, just to continue, since you picked West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet, right away we get intermediaries. You see, the first thing the lover does here, according to Andreas, after he becomes smitten and just can't get her out of his mind, and finally he just gets so wound up he has to act,
And what is the first thing he does? Get an intermediary. What's the first thing we get the nurse running back and forth? Intermediaries. So that here we have some of the key plot ingredients to romances written many years later. I mean, Romeo and Juliet comes in the early 17th century, late 16th, and then, of course, West Side Story is 20th century based on that. Other things that you see in one or another of these that would tend to bear out some of the motifs in this romantic love, part of courtly love thing.
Well, Cyrano de Bergerac has the intermediary person.
Cyrano de Bergerac has the intermediary, right? Good.
In an affair to remember, they're each committed to other people.
In the affair to remember, each are committed to other people. Now, when I read you some of the precepts here, you'll discover that, from the same text, the ultimate obstacle is that the person's married to somebody else. So that it turns out the premier instance of courtly love is, of course, Lancelot and Guinevere. Big problem here, okay? With Guinevere, right? She's married. Big obstacle here. Because not only is she married, she's married to the king, and the king, the first knight, Lancelot, the most loyal, etc. And now we go down the list here. The Bridges of Madison County. Is that a romantic liaison that takes place within marriage?
No.
No. It has its inception outside of marriage. The husband and the son, as I remember, are off at some tractor pull or something like that. I don't know. What is it?
State fair.
Yeah. And out comes the photographer, and there it is. One thing leads to another. And this just has this kind of short duration, extraordinarily intense. It takes place outside of marriage. We go right down. I don't know, Razor's Edge, out of Africa. Again, the Aesopanesian character is married. Her husband's marching all around. In comes Robert Redford in his airplane, and there we go. Casablanca, one of the great tearjerkers of all time. Here they've been lovers, they'll always have Paris. She believes that he's been killed. She's married. And here we have this extraordinary situation of, in Sam's place, in she comes. And there it is. And from there the plot thickens. But what makes it so powerful again is this this fueling of that old passion, this rekindling, because now there's this insuperable obstacle between the two of them, which is not only the marriage, but also the whole political situation and so forth, which again you had in Romeo and Juliet, politics, differing families, the obstacles multiply. Dr. Zhivago, talk about a world filled with long separations and enormous obstacles of territory and politics and everything. And yet it's one of the great love stories in Western literature. And again, what seems to feed it, what seems to increase it, what seems to deepen it, are all of these obstacles. Most frequently, phenom war or courtly love is adulterous love. But even when it isn't, as in the case of Romeo and Juliet, there are these enormous obstacles put up to make it difficult for the lovers to see one another regularly.
Well, English patient too, just one, you know, that's the picture, and that's like the biggest, you know, I mean, all he doesn't even really know her that well. I mean, all he does is sit there and like think about her and like draw little pictures about her. I mean, like, you know.
Exactly. Good example. And of course, it's an epic that has captivated people's hearts and imaginations. And it's astounding to me to see just how many of the ingredients are there in The Art of Courtly Love. And what has mystified historians, social and intellectual historians, is that there doesn't really seem to be anything like this in Western history before the 12th century. In other words, you certainly have instances of sexual passion in, say, Medea, any number of great Greek tragedies. But this kind of
romantic love as described here as a kind of suffering in which a man as well as a woman becomes pale and obsessed and more obsessed and gets intermediaries and finds that the only place in which one can locate and sustain this is secretly. It can't stand publicity. It's got to go on in secret. It's an affair to remember, etc. That seems to be utterly new. And one of the great Christian scholars of the period who studies this wrote a great book called Love in the Western World, Denis de Rougemont. And he says, you know, for all of the delights of romantic love, for all of its wonder and splendor and thrill, for all of its being a kind of gift, there's something finally about it that is deeply troublesome in that it seems bound up at its very root with its opposite, death. That is to say, the obstacles multiply and multiply and multiply so that not infrequently these love stories end in a kind of terrible tragedy that only leads to the death of the two lovers. Think of Romeo and Juliet, for example. Think of West Side Story. One could go on and on. Not all of them end that way. But also just the fact that if what nourishes this passion, if what really nourishes it is absence, what's the ultimate absence? Death. Okay? So that, in other words, if you say the more obstacles and the more absence, the more love, you can see how you get the kind of death potion, as you do in the Nibelung and other great myths of lovers, always involve a death potion, and that's bound up with the kind of final sleep or final separation. And finally, Denis de Rougemont says we have to think very carefully if we look at the roots of romantic love and see that it has a kind of dark side to it from the very beginning. I mean, I read you, and most of us chuckled at it because we recognized ourselves a little bit. Jealousy is the nurse of love, you know? Looked at one way, there's something very true about human psychology, that when we become jealous, we often find ourselves more ardently drawn to a person when they're beloved by another, okay? The more desired so-and-so is by others, the more desirable they become. That may be a fact about our human psychology, but from another side, it's a kind of dark spiritual truth that somehow this kind of love feeds on those kind of baser, less noble human inclinations, right? So you see how, in a way, we recognize these motifs in most of these. I think we covered all of them. I don't know, Razor's Edge. Did this have any of these motifs in it?
No, actually, it has a more modern approach to it. You, marriage for power, marriage for wealth.
It's a different kind of. Yeah. So the love takes place there within marriage?
Yeah.
In marriage. Rarely is that true. I mean, most of the romances you'll find in either they're not yet married or it's outside of it. I'll open it up for discussion in a minute, but I thought you'd get a kick out of the precepts here. You don't have these. I'm going to read you a few of the short rules that he winds up with. He who is not jealous cannot love. That which a lover takes against the will of his beloved has no relish. No one can love unless he is impelled by the persuasion of love. That's all right. Love is always a stranger in the home of avarice, meaning that if you are envious or greedy, then you can't love. Love is always a stranger there. It is not proper to love any woman whom one would also seek to marry. See, the opposite of love and marriage going together like a horse and carriage, right? They just don't go together. Marriage is no real excuse for not loving. If you're married, well, that's one thing, but you still want to love. Of course, it couldn't take place within marriage because, again, there are no obstacles there. You're together all the time, and how can that feed this particular passion? A man in love is always apprehensive. Again, it gets to that fear part. Remember that first page we read? Part of what makes love to be an inborn suffering is, first you fear that the person you love is not going to love you. Then that person does love you. Now you fear you're going to lose that person. So you're always fearful. And so you lead this life, which if someone read this from Mars, they'd say, you mean all these people really thought that this was great? Well, I guess we do, you know. There we are, all watching those films on sign. Let's see. He whom the thought of love vexes eats and sleeps very little. Every lover regularly turns pale in the presence of his beloved. When made public, love rarely endures. Okay, I've let you read enough and see enough, at least in these films and books, of this, according to most historians, new thing in the West in the 12th century. And we focused on the similarities. Would anybody care to begin to register some dissents or qualifications about how things really aren't that way any longer, or this definition really is flawed in its description of romantic love? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'd like to know first, we're talking about something new in the 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
What is it a transition from, and why? How did it come about?
Well, according to Denis de Rougemont, he attributes the rise of this new sentiment to a particular heresy, the Catharite heresy, which was brought into the West by the Cathars, who proposed a certain view of love that was in some ways ancestral to the kind that you get in Ovid. You'll see Ovid footnoted here in this text. And back into the kind of text we read the last time, a kind of highly charged eroticism that seeks union with the beloved, and that seeks it out of a longing that is here by the Catharite heresy dominantly sexual. You notice lust is first in the phase of psychosexual development. That is not true of the Greeks or the Greek story we read the last time. So you add sexuality as the prime motivating force, and you shift the whole configuration of social relations, which is bound up with this too. Men, women, at least in the upper classes, are becoming more equal, okay? In other words, this is not true of the middle or lower classes then, or lower classes really, but in the upper classes. So there's a kind of shift in the social history of the period. There's that heresy, that vein of new ideas, and that leads them to this new teaching and to this new experience. I don't think people became enthralled with romantic love because they read Andreas Capellanus. Instead, Andreas is meditating on and giving advice about something that he's really seeing going on around him. But it really finally is mystifying to explain such a profound psychological change. People before, though they were smitten by sexual longing, certainly prior to the 12th century, would not have spoken in such exalted terms publicly about something like adulterous love being fine love. I mean, that simply would not, you would have talked about marriage in the context of children mainly. Many of them were arranged. In some parts of Europe, in most parts of Europe, most of them were arranged. It was not something that you married for love, etc. And so this kind of fine sentiment was something that the vast experience of the population, just didn't experience. It was beyond their imaginations and the space they had in their lives for that, which requires a kind of leisure, which these courts have, and all kinds of other things. Now what's happened, according to de Rougemont, is that because our culture, your experience as you sit there and mine as I sit here, in terms of the wealth we command and the leisure in our lives, is much more like Eleanor's of Aquitaine. I mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine was a tiny, tiny 1% of 1% minority. But now, with democratization of wealth, leisure, and all the rest, we provide a kind of incubation for this kind of sentiment, which now becomes no longer an elite, but a democratic sentiment, and sanctioned, of course, constantly by what I've got on the board, which are the main teachers, the films we see, the books we read, the plays we see, and so forth, the songs we sang. We could have asked you to put up the lyrics of popular songs about romantic love, and we would have found all of these in there. So it's a sort of a, there's no single clause, there are sort of multiple clauses, but I think I've listed the major ones. The sort of social shift in the relation between men and women, increased leisure and wealth, the Catharite heresy, which is a kind of new view of eros that places sexuality at a higher level than it was among the Greeks in that, and it sort of powers this sentiment. Then of course you get the troubadours carrying those poems around and reciting them at court, and you get works like Evain and Lancelot, which play the same role in that culture that Bridges of Madison County and what was the one, The English Patient, play in ours. Even films like that are more artsy, like Bergman's great film, Scenes from a Marriage, that set out to debunk this myth, wind up getting caught in it. It starts out with four married couples in Scenes from a Marriage, and eventually their marriages grow stale and come apart, but their affairs are shown to be pretty tawdry as well. But ironically, the one married couple gets together at the end and has this powerful romantic sentiment again between them, but can only have that, oddly, when they're not married. And they decide not to get married for fear that that will disappear. So it kind of reinforces this same notion that if you're going to give privilege to this love, this fin amour, this romantic love, you're sort of doomed in a way, because marriage will kill it by definition, given the way it's defined here. Okay? And the only way you can find it is outside of marriage, and it's bound up. The only way it will thrive is if you continue to throw up these obstacles. Again, that's sort of the love and death motif, which Nina Bouchon warns against. Okay, other dissents or criticisms. There was another hand here. I think you had yours. No?
I think the one.
Okay. Yes?
Well, it seems like in here, it's in The Art of Courtly Love, it's he makes it clear, you know, that if the obstacles are gone, the love's going to be gone. But I think, I mean, what makes all of us really sad at these movies is because the assumption is that if the obstacle were gone, everything would be really great. You know, like, if she didn't have a husband in the Bridges of Madison County, then they'd have this, they could get married and have this perfect love forever, and that'd be really great, when in reality, if you really thought about it, it would probably be awful, you know. So it seems like they're more honest about it almost, you know, in the 12th century than we are with ourselves now when we go to these movies.
Yeah, because the movies always end before people
right.
take up.
Right.
You have to pay the water bill.
Right.
Never get around to figuring out how they're going to manage the water bill. It ends by then, and we're left. Good point. That's a good point. Other dissents, I mean, do you... they may have a good word to say. I kind of presented this with my own slant, which is to say, for all that this is a in a way a wonderful thing when one's in the grip of it, to call it suffering, which is what he calls it, to say it's riddled with fear, to say it thrives on obstacles, is not a particularly pretty picture. Not something you want to kind of sing about in song, although people sing about nothing else. And so I'm wondering whether people have a kind of good word to say for this. I don't want to have you all leave and say, oh, this class teacher, you know, is dumping on romantic love. He's kind of a puritan.
Well, some of this reminds me of the college days. You know, I went overseas and then I went to college, but, you know, the girlfriend back home, and I know a lot of these guys, especially when I would leave, I was leaving the University of Maryland area around the holidays, so I offered, put up a thing, anybody need to ride home. A lot of guys show up and they're riding home to their girlfriends, you know, and it's that thing, you know, the girlfriend back home or the boyfriend, or, you know, we go to Central Washington, he goes to BYU or something. And so I see some of this like the moon-shaped love cows, you know, early 20s. And but as far as, you know, long-term, I think she hit the nail on the head about what happens if they could do it. And I thought of Cinderella, that story, you know, because, you know, they get married. And, you know, the day after the wedding, you know, he says, I'm going out with the boys and shoot fox. And she sticks around and doesn't, she can't talk to any of the noble women. She doesn't know it. So she winds up helping in the kitchen and checking out the stable because that's what she knows. And he comes home that night and he's pissed. Because he says, you're a noble woman. You don't go down there to the kitchen or to the stable. And so I like what you said, because it's like, what happens the day after, you know, now that you're together. So, but I think this is like, maybe some of this is like a developmental stage in courting today, you know, this internet love, you know. I mean, you know, these people make relationships. And somebody's in Minnesota, somebody's in California, and they meet in Colorado.
Yeah.
You know?
Now you see, that's interesting. The internet phenomenon and the great story about C.S. Lewis and the woman that he fell in love with through letters suggests that there's something wrong. Capilano wants to say it always has to start with sight. If you read that definition, it's an inborn suffering derived from the sight, and then the excessive meditation on the beloved. And some loves have started over the phone, via internet, via letters, where what you really get is their voice, their minds on paper, etc. And I've often thought it would be interesting to study whether or not it turns out, as in the case of Lewis, that those relationships really do, those loves really do endure, simply because what links the people together, what they fall in love with, is something much more essentially what each is. His or her thoughts, ideas, stories, values, aspirations, longings, rather than his or her physique, physical appearance, etc., etc. And I often thought it would be an interesting experiment to find out whether people who have fallen in love via letters or internet or something like that do wind up staying together longer. I don't know if that's a fact, I just think it would be an interesting experiment.
It's helped me. I'm a divorce lawyer, and it's helped me because it started jealousy, and I get a lot of divorces out of internet affairs.
Oh, is that right?
You betcha. They walk in.
Is that right? Internet affairs?
You betcha, because one of the spouses will see the bill, you know, and then the next thing you know, they meet in Cincinnati, and you know, it's like, I hear it. I've heard about a dozen. So, you know, after the second one, I'm like, oh, yeah, I've heard that. Come on.
I've done that.
Make sure he pays that bill. Right?
Yes.
I guess I'm wondering, you know, we've just bought into that this is the definition of love. And I guess I wonder if this is a better definition of lust.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm wondering. I'm inviting criticism of the definition. Go ahead.
I would say that. this defines lust. I mean, you know, I don't want to say that because he's in the room. As I think of a person in my life, you know, when we see these movies, I get caught up in them, but, you know, they always, they work for me, but it's not love. This stuff isn't real. This is not, I mean, it's real, but it's not real love.
It's not mature love.
Well, yeah.
It's kind of like starting a fire. When you start a match, when you strike that match, it's fire, correct, but it's certainly nothing to keep you warm for very long.
Well, you know, we call it puppy love. I mean, I think there's death, but I would, you know, this is not mature love or real love. This is lust. And I think he's very clear about that. You know,
he said it starts with lust, that's right, right in the second column.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you said, you wonder about how you can use all her body parts. $50 is the definition of lust to me.
Okay, so you would want to say that it really is a definition of lust, and I think you'd want to say it's a definition of infatuation or something
well,
like that.
I mean,
immature love, I think.
Right, from the fact that we're all animals, and different animals have different basic ways of finding mates. And we just happen to have a fairly complex one that starts that relationship that hopefully matures to the point that the couple stay together. And that's why I see that what they're showing here is that beginning, the animal segment of us that hopefully endures with the maturing of the love also. Mm-hmm. But it's merely the primer to get things started, because without it, the consequences, especially before the era that we're in now, the burden and responsibility of beginning a family was an awesome task for both male and female. And if there wasn't something that overrode rational thought, we would not be here today. And consequently, that's, you know, an inborn gift from God to perpetuate the species. This lust that we talk about. But here, of course, it's the way it's being handled in the court is basically, you know, kind of a hobby.
But this, you cannot call this a primer of love, because he's very honest in saying this is not meant to lead to a long-lasting thing. I think that's the problem, is that these stories, I mean, this has all been touched on, but we assume that this kind of romantic feeling, love, lust, whatever you want to call it, is the primer for marriage, because we look at all these wonderful movies, but exactly right, we don't see the day after stuff. And so I think our society has bought into this as a definition of what love is, mm-hmm. and then this love will deepen, but this love can deepen. This guy's exactly right. This stuff lasts as long as, you know, what all the obstacles are there. It's lust. It doesn't lead anywhere.
Excellent, yes.
Aren't there a lot of myths, though, that talk about the day after, or, you know, how the Native American woman who marries the shaman and thinks she's married this amazing man, and the next day after they're married, he turns into a snake, you know? And myths that basically depict that breaking of the magic, you know, once the actual reality of the relationship hits in. I think throughout history there have been that kind of mythology depicting that moment where the what's called the stir the oatmeal love actually has to kick in. So I don't know. I agree. I don't know that I kind of go with the primer idea. I think that it's possible because you know, reality is there, and certainly many relationships have happened, started with the romantic love and then moved into the real workaday love.
They have, yeah. But I'm afraid that if folks are right here, and I think they are, I mean, this is a definition that looks like, although it's called romantic love, and surely involves, I think, more than just lust, though I think it does involve a great deal of lust. I mean, the whole role of the imagination in here is different from what the squirrels say would be. I mean, the squirrels would be driven by biological urges, but wouldn't, I don't think, though I can't prove this.
Take a series of interviews.
Pine. I don't think they pine away for each other. You know, one squirrel's gone.
Who would show you a fluffy tail?
I think there's something added here that makes romance romance than just lust. I mean, I think there's this role of the imagination, but I think that we're in difficulty if we can't, with young people especially, have works of literature and film and music and popular culture that depict for them somewhere rich, mature love, within marriage, or at least with people who have to deal with the morning after. And this seems to be constantly, you notice this text is constantly seeking to recreate the first moment, you see? In other words, things begin to wane, well, I'll take a trip. Things begin to wane, well, I'll look at someone else. Then jealousy, you know? So there's this getting stuck on the dime here in this immature love. And most of these films, I think you'll agree, even though they're great, have that kind of way of getting stuck. And aren't we kind of in difficulty if we have a better way to lift up some other kind of model about mature love? Yeah, Chuck.
I read something recently, and it talks about relationships, and it says you can have a physical relationship with 1 out of 100 people. You can have a mental relationship with 1 out of 1,000. You can have a spiritual relationship with 1 out of 10,000, which kind of shows you the difficulty of having relationships. It's easy to have a physical relationship, And his final point in this book was, the greatest love that you can show is to help a person grow spiritually. And that wasn't a religious book. It was, you know, spiritual in a different sense than religious. But that was the greatest love, which would be in the final relationship with one out of 100,000 or 10,000 people.
Now, if we could just have some imaginative literature out there that would depict this in a compelling way.
Yeah. It's just as difficult to put out a movie or a book as it is to have the relationship in the first place. That's why we have physical books rather than mental or spiritual books.
I'm going to call you in just a minute. One thing I think is kind of a one little hope, I'm going to leave everybody with some hope in popular culture. I think the revival of Jane Austen and the fact that people are making films of Jane Austen novels. Jane Austen is an extraordinarily subtle and a woman of tremendous sanity and depth. And the fact that the popular culture has begun to pick up on Pride and Prejudice and Emma and so on is at least one sign of hope, I think. Yes?
I think to comment on that, her stories are often very much this framework where there's that longing and that he said, she said, and all that introducing and whatnot. I mean, they tend to end up maybe, well, I don't even know. I just read Pride and Prejudice not too long ago and seen Emma. I don't know if I would agree that Jane Austen's going to say that.
you also see very good marriages made in Jane Austen.
Yeah, yeah. But the other thing I was going to say in hearing this list of things, reading this information, is I used to teach middle school, and it sounds like middle school romance to me. Big time. I mean, it's, you know, they just pine away, and oh my gosh, he said, and the jealousy thing is just insane. You can't teach some of these students because they're just not there for you. And interesting that, you know, what they see in broader culture, I mean, they take their soap operas and go home and watch them, and, you know, they watch these movies and they read their, you know, young person's versions of Harlequins and whatnot. And I mean, I think it's, you know, developmentally that's where they're at, too, mentally and physically and everything. But hopefully somewhere along the line as they grow up and get older and wiser, that they'll go beyond that. But definitely his work fits with middle school.
Very astute. I think that's a great last word. Since we're over time, I'll sum it up this way. If these films are any indication, Western culture in general is still stuck in the Middle Ages. And if you're right, most adults are still stuck in middle school.